Thank you, Professor Shima. Can you all hear me?
No.
Let's try again. Better? I shall try to speak as loud as necessary and hope that my voice remains useful for more than an hour. As Professor Shima mentioned, I was once a professor, and in those days I had to give many lectures, and my voice was accustomed to it. But for the past 12 years, I have not been a regular professor and do not give regular lectures, and as a result, my voice has grown weaker. And perhaps as time passes, it will become strong enough that it won't prove to be a problem. I do understand that listening to Americans may be a problem for you, because you may have noticed that we speak English in many different ways. That some are surely easier for you to understand. In my country, I sometimes find I cannot understand people who speak English, especially in places such as Boston and New York City. But the United States is, as I will emphasize in my lectures, a very large country, full of diverse people, including diverse modes of speech. I do speak more slowly than the average American, and I hope that will help you if you're not comfortable with listening to English. In my country, people want me to hurry. They find I'm too slow. Before I begin my actual lecture for today, I want to give you a preview of what my course of lectures will involve. When Professor Shima invited me to come here and give a series of lectures, he gave me my choice as to what I would speak about. And I thought it advisable that I speak of something I know about. So I selected a topic which I called Political Economy in the Light of History. That means I will be talking about political economy, which is the relationship between things political and things economic, and how they affect one another. But I will be discussing that relationship in connection with actual historical events. There are some subjects we can learn without having any experience, which is to say, we can learn logic, we can learn mathematics, and in one sense, we can learn economic theory, or what more properly is called praxeology. We don't need to know about what has happened in the past or what is happening now in the world to learn and understand and use logic, mathematics, and praxeology. We have knowledge of those things from the way our minds work. We can learn logic because our minds work in such a way that we cannot conceive of something being in a condition A and at the same time in a condition not A. And because our minds are constrained by that reality, logic can be developed on that basis, the basis that Something must be non-contradictory with itself in order to have meaning. But history is different, and I'll talk a little bit at the beginning of my lecture today about how the study of history differs from the study of logic, mathematics, or praxeology, but at the same time, how the two kinds of learning are connected and how they relate to one another. So I will begin today by talking about basic concepts that I'll be using throughout my lectures. I will then begin to talk about history, or even what we should call prehistory. What happened to human beings before the time that we know about from any written records, before the time when we can even find many records of archaeological variety. But it's important to start at the very beginning, because the way human beings evolved over millions of years still has an effect on their thinking and acting today. It was during that long period that human beings developed what we now might call human nature. And whatever we've accomplished in the past 10,000 years as a species, we have not changed human nature in that period. So we need to understand how the environment in which human beings lived during the time that they developed human nature continues to have an effect on their thinking and their acting today. So I'll begin with prehistory. Not much, don't worry. And then I'll move on and talk for a little while about some basic elements of ancient history. History up to the beginning of the Middle Ages, say up to about the year 500. And that will fill up today's lecture. The second lecture, I'll talk about the Middle Ages. The first part of it is often called, in English, the Dark Ages. That's too bad that it's called the Dark Ages. It was no darker than today. The sun still came up as usual. But in certain respects, it represented a falling away from the civilization that had developed during the time of the Roman Empire in the West. Often when we talk about history, we begin to talk, as I will, as if the history of the West is the only thing that we care about. We need to remember that other people in other places had histories also, and while the West was falling into a so-called dark age, other civilizations were flourishing and progressing, and the course of history was proceeding differently for them. But we are Westerners here, and it's fair for us to emphasize our own background, and indeed we must if we're going to understand our current realities. So I'll talk about the Middle Ages tomorrow, and following that I will talk about what we call the rise of the West, that is, the western part of Europe. The part that, more or less corresponded to the part outside the East Bloc during the Cold War. Not exactly, but roughly. There were exceptions, of course, including what is now the Czech Republic. Certainly a place that participated fully in the rise of the West and in Western civilization, but nonetheless had the misfortune to fall under communism. So I'll talk about the rise of the West, and especially about the shift of the most progressive places in Europe from the Mediterranean to the countries facing the Atlantic. That was an important change for all world history, and certainly for the history afterwards of Europe. I'll deal with the emergence of nation states starting in the 15th century, which brought onto the scene a new form of political organization, unlike anything that had existed previously, and in important ways, both positive and negative, changed the course of Western history. And of course, nowadays, the whole world is divided to some extent into nation states, or areas that nation states presume to control, and over which they sometimes wage wars of control. That will consume my second lecture. In the third lecture, I'll talk about Europe's expansion overseas, especially to the Western Hemisphere, where the Spaniards, the Portuguese, first established empires, and later the French, the English, the Dutch, the Danes had offshoots of their own. And from these European offshoots eventually came colonies of Great Britain that formed the basis for what is now the United States of America. At the end of my third lecture, I'll talk about the American colony secession from the British Empire and their establishment of independence for themselves. After that, in all the remaining lectures, I will discuss almost entirely the United States alone. I do that not because I think this is the only place in the world that's important, but it's the only place in the world about which I know enough to talk seven times. So I hope you will bear in mind my limitations. And I also think that although there are certain peculiarities in the history of the United States, things that do not apply elsewhere, there is much that does apply. We can learn a great deal of general application from the history of the United States. It's not a small and insignificant country. Eventually, it has come to be the superpower of the world, and for better or worse, what has happened in the development of the United States has come to affect almost everyone in the world. So I won't give you the outline for each lecture afterwards, but only tell you that they all deal with the United States and with policy making, especially in that country. Now, in my first lecture, or my first two lectures, you may not see a lot that has immediate application to policy, but I will try to take note of those parts of these lectures that do have relevance for understanding policy. I begin with them only because I believe this background is important for understanding better the material that comes in the later lectures. So be patient. Don't give up. I've come a long way to speak to you. So it's very good to see that you've come to listen. Let me start now by discussing for a while some basic concepts of analysis that will be used by me, which are used by everyone who studies political economy or economics. They have to do with theory and history and the distinctions or relations between those two categories of understanding. Praxeology is a word that many people never see when they study economics, even if they study in university. I studied all the way through to my PhD degree in a university in the United States and never saw the word praxeology. My professors talked a lot about theory, but not about praxeology. I'm not sure if this word was invented by Ludwig von Mises or not, but it has become familiar to most people through Mises' writings and teachings, and that's how I myself began to learn about it. I've asked Professor Shima to distribute to you some background readings for my lectures, and the first one is a part of Mises' book, Human Action, from the chapter on epistemology, the theory of knowledge. I want you to know this is the most difficult thing on my reading list. So if you don't understand it all the first time, don't be surprised. I'm still reading it myself after 30 years, still trying to understand it all. So it's difficult, but it's especially difficult if you have learned in the past something that seems to disagree with or to be in conflict with what Mises is saying. Even now, most people who study the social sciences, or economics in particular, do not follow the teachings of Mises. I did not, when I began my life as an economist, follow the teachings of Mises, nor did I understand epistemology in the way that he recommends. I followed the mainstream or commonly taught epistemology of modern economics, which is sometimes called positivism, which is a way of shaping the study of economics almost by imitation with the study of 19th century physics. Now notice I said 19th century physics because I think nowadays even physicists do not practice scientific study in the way that economists think they do. So economists' understanding in the mainstream now is very much already out of date, and I believe it is modeled on the wrong science anyhow, that economics should never have been understood as something we can study and understand using the same methods we use to study physical reality. I'll come back in a moment to the main reason why that is so. Economic theory, in the Misesian view, is a part of praxeology. Praxeology is the study of human action in general. Human action means, for Mises, action to achieve a desired end. Action that has a purpose in the mind of the actor. If I blink my eyes, or if my arm jerks because my muscle contracts involuntarily, that's a behavior, but not a human action. I never intended those behaviors to occur. I did not choose them. I did not make a conscious decision to do something in an effort to improve my situation. Human action always springs, as Mises said, from felt uneasiness. Now that sounds like discomfort. That sounds like something painful, but it does not have to be anything painful or uncomfortable. Felt uneasiness simply means that I recognize my condition as one which could be improved. I could make my condition better by taking a certain action. And it is for that reason that I act. I act with a purpose. I have an end in mind. That is the principal reason why the methods of physics are not appropriate to the study of human action. We do not believe that atoms and molecules have a purpose in mind when they interact with other physical entities. They have certain behaviors. We can predict what they do under certain conditions. If we don't have the ability to predict those changes, we can do experiments to find out. And when we do an experiment with physical entities, we believe that the results of that experiment, if we are careful, can be reproduced in any number of other experiments with the same result. Human action is not that kind of behavior. We may see someone react to a particular situation in one way, yet we have no assurance that the person will always react in that same way in that same situation. Why? Because unlike atoms, molecules, subatomic particles, human beings have consciousness, purpose, and the ability to learn and change their minds about what will best serve their interests. We don't think atoms can learn. The hydrogen atom cannot learn that it's a big mistake to combine with oxygen to produce water. We don't think that's possible. We do think, however, that people who believe that one course of action will improve their situation can learn from experience, instruction, imagination, that they were wrong, and that a different course of action will better serve their interests. So, human action can be studied only in ways differently from the study of the natural or biological sciences. What is that way? That way it is in a way that is like the study of logic. We begin with the axiom, the basic belief that human action exists, and from that we deduce logically how an actor would respond to certain situations or changes in the situation he faces. Those deductions do not need to be verified by experiment. They would be like looking for a way to confirm that the interior angles of a triangle sum to 180 degrees. You wouldn't go out and measure every triangle in the world you could find and make records saying, 45, 30, we'll add up the angles. Do they sum to 180? No, you can learn from the axioms of geometry by logic that they must sum to 180 degrees. They have to. It's in the nature of a triangle. It's in the nature of a human actor to behave in certain ways, logically, in accordance with a rational mind. In a sense, human action is nothing more than what we mean by rationality. Mises even goes so far as to claim that people who seem to be insane, crazy, may also be rational if we understand correctly what they believe will serve their interests. They may have funny beliefs. We may look at their beliefs and say, well, that makes no sense. But if we acknowledge that they have certain beliefs, it may still be true that they are behaving in a way that chooses correct means for the achievement of their ends. When we study history, we're studying what Mises called complex phenomena. Complex phenomena are those for which we may find many contributing causes. We're not even sure how many causes may exist. We may not know what they all are. If we ask a question such as, why did Great Britain go to war against Germany in 1914? We could answer that question in any number of different ways. There are surely many causes that contributed to the decision by the government of Great Britain to go to war against Germany in 1914. So in telling that historical story, in giving an historical account, each historian might tell it differently, might place emphasis on different factors, might talk about some factors that other historians never mention. And yet, in some way, each historian could be telling us something useful in understanding the event, in answering the question we've put. This is not like doing the experiment with oxygen and hydrogen to produce water. Because, among other things, we cannot replay the experiment of life in 1914. We can't go back to 1913 and change something and say, well, now let's investigate what happens if we don't have some event in 1913. If something had been different, if someone had been a different prime minister in 1913, if the Germans had changed their policy in some important way, any number of things might have been different, but we'll never know for sure because we can't make an experiment out of historical experience. We might take a little piece of experience and do an experiment in a laboratory, but that's artificial. That's not another try at history. There cannot be any second tries at history, because whole societies are not manipulable. We can't move them around like pieces on a chessboard. So when we study history, complex behavior, we have to use other methods. Now, of course, we can use praxeology, because when people behave, we have to understand that their actions, in their own understanding, serve their purposes. But in history, we have to ask about the details, the specific beliefs they held, the ideas they had about what was better and worse for them, their ideas about how the world worked, how certain events would give rise to certain consequences, all of that makes a difference for understanding their actions. So in historical study, we combine praxeology, the understanding of people as seeking to improve their condition by using the best means they know to improve their condition, but we need to go beyond that. We need to be specific and concrete and to use the method of understanding, which is a method of trying to get inside the heads of the historical actors to say, what was Winston Churchill thinking in 1914? What was Kaiser Wilhelm thinking in 1914? How did they look out at the world? How did they associate their beliefs about the world and how things in the world were connected with how they might act to improve their own situation? Now notice one more thing. When we study history and try to use the method of understanding, we always must talk about the understanding of individual people. This is a principle called methodological individualism. That means we cannot make sense of history by asking about the desires or motives or interests of classes, of groups of people, of nations, because those are concepts that do not act. They're convenient categories for organizing our understanding sometimes, but they often mislead analysts because they begin to talk as if an entire nation had an interest. An entire class had an interest. An entire nation had a belief. A class had a belief. But that makes no sense because those categories are not actors. They cannot look out at the world and think, how can I improve my condition by taking a specific action? So even though it often helps us to talk about events by talking about groups, by lumping people together, we need to always remember that only the individuals are capable of human action, and when all of their actions are combined, we may get something we would call the actions of a nation or the actions of a class, but we can't understand the logic of action at that level. Now, I'm going to be talking about history, and two ideas or concepts will be essential for us in this respect. The first is the concept of an institution. This is a common word in every language, I think. It's often used in social science and history, but it does not have an accepted standard meaning. It's used differently. Sometimes it's used in ways that mean different things. For many people, an institution means something we can see, like a bank, a business firm, a government. They might think that's an institution, but those are examples of institutions. Other people think about institutions in a more abstract way. They say institutions are best conceived as rules of the game. That's the expression my former colleague Douglas North uses to talk about institutions. They're the rules of the game. They tell people what is permissible and not permissible in a certain situation. So that if I am driving an automobile in the United States, one institution is driving normally on the right-hand side of the road if the traffic is going two ways. In Great Britain, driving on a two-way street, the institution is drive on the left-hand side. Those Brits, you know, it must be difficult. But when you're in this situation, it serves your interest to be aware of the institution that prevails there and to accommodate your behavior to it. If you insist on behaving contrary to the rules, you can find that you're not able to achieve your ends very quickly. You may even have a disaster. So, rules of the game, that's a helpful way to start thinking about institutions, but it's so vague, it doesn't get us very far. It doesn't help very much, because all kinds of things might be called rules of the game. Everything from the rules of private property to the rules of how representatives are selected to serve in legislatures, you name it. Rules of the game. That's vague. I have found it helpful to think about institutions in a way that was formulated by two sociologists, Thomas Berger and Thomas Luckmann. They wrote a book 40 years ago called The Social Construction of Reality. This is a very good book, by the way. If you ever want to study a subject called the sociology of knowledge, I recommend the book by Berger and Luckmann. But in that book, they define institutions more as sociologists might in this way. They call them, and this is hard to absorb, I'll repeat it. They call an institution a reciprocal typification of routinized actions by types of actors. So first of all, let's go back. An institution has to do with types of actors, not with any particular actor, not with any specific actor. If we have the institution of driving on the right-hand side of the road, that means that whether the driver is Mr. Smith or Mr. Jones or Professor Shima, driving on the right-hand side of the road applies. It's the institution. So it applies to types of actors in general. It might apply to drivers, to voters, to soldiers, to presidents, all kinds of types of actors. It has to do with these actors' routinized actions. That is, actions they take over and over and over, again and again. No novelty here. When you go out and drive your automobile on the road, that's something you've done before, you'll do again. Many people do the same action, driving their automobile down the street. That's a routinized action. If I were to try to give you a lecture today standing on my head on the desk, that would be a non-routine action. I've never done it before. I would have difficulty doing it today. You couldn't understand that as having anything to do with institutions. Institutions are about repeated actions, repeated kinds of actions. When you meet someone on the street, in some countries you acknowledge them, you say, good morning, or you may nod your head, you may do something that is common in your culture to acknowledge the meeting of someone. That's a routinized action. It doesn't matter whom you meet. Doesn't matter who you are in particular or who the person is in particular that you're meeting, any two people in that situation, which recurs for all people, is a routinized action for types of actors. And finally, in these situations, institutions are reciprocal typifications, which means that when I meet someone on the street and I nod my head, that means to that person the same thing that I want it to mean. Now, there may be other cultures in which it would be dangerous for me to meet someone, a stranger, and nod my head. Maybe in another culture that means, this is what I do before I try to kill you. Of course, cultures differ. Customs differ in the world. What is polite or expected or institutionalized in some cultures is impolite, not expected, and condemned in other cultures. So we have a saying, and maybe you do too, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. So do not deviate from the institutions of the place, the culture, the group of people in which you are taking your action. Because what happens if you do? The first thing is you will surprise people. You'll surprise them. They're accustomed to seeing one form of behavior in a certain situation and responding in a certain way. But if you surprise them, then they're not sure how to react. If I get up and stand on my head here, are you going to stay and watch me? Are you going to walk out? I don't know, but I assure you, you'll be surprised. But as it is, if I merely give you a lecture, then perhaps you'll continue to listen and let me talk and not try to talk at the same time. So that's an institution of teacher-student relationship in a lecture classroom. We understand that. We've all been in that situation many times before. Now, institutions are vitally important because they establish incentives and constraints on people's actions. If I want to get along with people, then I should follow the institutions. If it's expected that when I meet someone in the morning, I will be friendly, I will smile, I will nod, I will say guten Tag, or whatever is appropriate, then I should do that if I want to get along well in that situation. I don't want to surprise people. So there's an incentive for me to behave according to established institutions, and it constrains my behavior at the same time. I know that if I deviate from the established institutions, I may have misfortune. I may have disaster even, if it's something like driving on the wrong side of the road. So there are constraints and incentives associated with all institutions. When we talk about the institution of private property, there are incentives created by that. If I own something, I have an incentive not to destroy its value. There are constraints of private property. If you do not own something I own, then you are not to interfere with my control over it. If this is my book, which it just happens to be, and I have the private property right to this book, and you attempt to simply come up and take it away, then I might call upon others to help me defend my property, or I might call the police if I think they'll be helpful. I might take various actions, and if private property is actually an established institution, there will be responses to those who violate the institution. There will be some form of punishment or constraint protection of the behavior that takes place according to that institution. So we need to understand what these are, how they changed historically, because they reshaped the actions that people chose to take in pursuing their own interest. And a final concept that I'll be talking about a good deal, ideology. This is also a disputed concept. Many people use this word, even in the sciences, differently. I have a certain way of using it that I find useful. I did not invent this. I took it from other scholars, but as I say, some scholars would not agree with this use of the term ideology. In my usage, ideology is a belief system, not just any little belief, not just the belief that I have a bottle in my hand, but a system of belief about social relations, about how people deal with one another in society. So it applies to people's economic dealings, to their exchanges of property rights in the market, for example, as well as to their social dealings in the sense of informal interactions with each other, anything that has to do with the way people relate to each other in society is something that may fall within the domain of ideology. Ideology is a fairly complex idea. It has at least four dimensions. The first is cognitive. It has to do with understanding. If you have a belief system about how the world works, you look out and things make sense to you in terms of that system of belief. If I have a belief system like what's called classical liberalism, the old liberalism, the liberalism of the 19th century in Europe, and I look out at the world and I see, for example, someone becoming an employee of a firm. And I say, what does that mean? That means that an exchange is taking place. That a worker has exchanged the right to control that worker's labor power on fixed terms, always limited, in exchange for a payment of a wage or a salary. So there's an exchange of property rights going on there. And when I see that, I think that's the kind of exchange that improves the condition of all parties to the exchange. The employer wants to hire someone, is willing to pay a certain amount. That is an amount acceptable to the employee, and that's good. So I not only have a way of understanding it, but I have a way of evaluating it, of saying whether it's good or bad or just neutral. Okay? So that's another dimension of ideology, the moral dimension, whether the relations we see in the world are proper, are right, are ethical, are praiseworthy, or are they evil, wrong, bad. We can see things in a different light. Now, if I had a different ideology, let's suppose I'm a Marxist. I look at the same event. I see a firm hiring a wage worker. And that has a completely different meaning to me now. I now see not a mutually beneficial exchange. I see an exploitive relationship. I see a capitalist bloodsucker who is entering into a control over someone's labor power in order to gain profit in an unworthy or evil manner. So, ideology gives us a way of understanding the world and of judging it, good, bad, indifferent. At the same time, it propels people's political action. It tells me there are certain political movements, positions that deserve my support, others that do not. If I'm a classical liberal and someone wants me to join a revolutionary Marxist party, I decline. Say, no, that's not something that follows from my view of the world and my way of appraising what is happening in the world. If I have a Marxist ideology, I may say, yes, sign me up. I'm with you, comrade. So the programmatic aspect is another part of ideology. And the final aspect, the fourth aspect of ideology, I call solidary, because one's belief system has to do with the kind of people one wants to be associated with. Ideologies bring people into groups of people who think the same way about how the world works, how it should work, how arrangements ought to be changed, what political programs deserve support. And this solidary aspect is especially important because it's that leads people to take political action even in conditions where it might not be rational in an instrumental sense for them to take any political action. They might want to be, as economists call it, free riders. They might say, oh, I'm a revolutionary, all right, but I don't want to go to the barricades today because you might get killed out there. And frankly, whether I go or not will not change the success of the revolution, so I'm going to stay home, thank you. If I thought about my ideology like that, I would be a free rider. I would not join in large group political actions. Those actions where my individual participation is not decisive one way or the other. But if everyone free rides, nothing happens. We know things do happen. We know sometimes people do participate as members of groups in large group political action. And I believe they do that primarily because solidarity with their comrades impels them to act in the service of their own self-respect. We say to people who want to shirk, who want to hold out, what kind of a person are you? That's asking, aren't you the decent kind of person I think you are, who is willing to pay a price, willing to make some personal sacrifice for what you say is right? Are you just dishonest? What kind of a person are you? Well, that's a sanction. That's the kind of constraint that makes many people act when they otherwise would choose to be the free rider. So ideologies are sometimes very important for getting people into action, but always important in how people understand the world and appraise the world for good and evil. Now let me turn very quickly to some prehistory. We know about this from archaeology, for the most part, from a few bones that have been dug up, from other remains, physical remains from the life of human beings in the past. The species we call Homo sapiens, the human beings, emerged approximately 2 million years ago. We don't know exactly when. It's not the kind of development that can be given an exact date, because we presume that before there were human beings, there were ancestors of human beings that were not so different. And gradually, through the course of evolution, over a very long time, these other creatures became what we recognize as human beings. But if we say that human beings are a species that has existed for approximately 2 million years, then the most important thing we can recognize is that for almost that entire period, for more than 99% of that entire time that human beings have existed on Earth, they existed in a certain condition. And that was, they lived in very small groups, perhaps no more than four or five families together, sometimes as many perhaps as 20 or 25 families, maybe 100 persons altogether, but almost never in larger groups, very small groups of people. That was the human condition for 99.5% of the human past. Small groups living by gathering from nature what they needed to survive. Something to eat, some way to find shelter, some way to defend their young against predators and other animals that threaten them. Small groups hunting, gathering, reliant on nature. So when we think about what is human nature, we need to think about something that was formed, perhaps even genetically shaped, not just customs, not just habits of humanity, but perhaps even part of our biological makeup, formed in a situation where people were always together with a small number of related individuals. They were all related by blood. They formed a small clan. This is important because this human nature, this way of thinking that might have been appropriate for human beings living in very small numbers, all related by blood, all knowing one another very well, all with an interest that depended critically on the other members of that group and required sharing and perhaps even self-sacrifice to protect the young from danger. Those kinds of outlooks, mental outlooks, may have persisted in a modern situation in which humans exist by the billions on the planet, sometimes living in huge groups like the city of Prague, more than 1 million people. No one in this city knows more than a few other inhabitants of this city. It's not possible. So now we all live in what Hayek, the great economist Friedrich Hayek, called the Great Society. Too big to deal with as we deal with a family. Too big to deal with as we deal with a small group of people known to us personally. And yet, our ways of thinking may still be those appropriate to small groups of related, interdependent people. And those ways of thinking may be actually counterproductive. They may be ways of thinking that are harmful to us, especially in the formation of economic policy. Very often, economic policymakers ask us to do something by asking us, for example, to to share in some communal sacrifice. When governments go to war, they always ask for citizens to come forth and assist them in defending the territory, or perhaps in attacking another territory. They want cooperation, even though it's dangerous and costly. Now, we didn't have to worry when we had a group of 50 individuals. If a wild animal threatened the group, all of the people capable of defending the group would go and defend it. Each one's interest was clearly part of the interest of the whole group. Free riding did not make sense in a small group. But to apply the logic of small groups to a great society is often to make a mistake, and often to take a position that makes people vulnerable to exploitation by leaders and by those who would have them make sacrifices supposedly for the betterment of the group, but actually for the betterment of the leaders. And we may be tricked easily, because that's the kind of people we are. We're people who readily think, oh yes, I should sacrifice myself. I should contribute to the communal purpose. And yet by behaving in that way, we may indirectly harm the interests of the great society, and as a result, harm our own interests later. In these small groups, there was a kind of authority. No doubt, there were often one or two persons, probably men, because men tended to be the dominant species in hunter-gatherer clans. One or two men who would have more authority, they might make decisions sometimes for others, although even that was no doubt informal. When the white people first went to the part of the United States that's now the Northwest, they tried to make treaties with the Indian tribes. And so they would ask for the chief, and the Indians would look around. They didn't have a chief. If they needed to decide something, they got all the men together and had a big talk. And they talked about it, and they finally decided the best thing to do. But they had no leadership. They had no political command. Well, that was the situation of our primitive ancestors for millions of years. They had no real political leadership. They had no one whose interest was ever really apart from the interests of the others in any important way. Family-based, traditional leadership. No government as we think of government now. They had very little division of labor. Everybody did the same kinds of tasks. Probably there was some division by sex. The men probably did most of the hunting. The women took care of the children and food preparation, gathering plant materials from nature. But other than the sexual difference, no division of labor that was important. Every man did the same kinds of tasks. Every woman did the same kinds of tasks. Productivity was very, very low. These groups. They produced, if they were lucky, enough to survive. And in producing, they were always very much dependent on luck and on nature. If the weather was wrong, the weather was bad, the animals they usually hunted did not appear, or were not so many in number, the people might starve. They might die. And surely they often did. Because we know that the numbers of people on earth grew very, very, very slowly for those first 2 million years. Only in the past few centuries did the growth of population become very much greater than zero. It took almost 2 million years to reach 1 million people on earth, and then in only two more centuries, that 1 million became several billions. So population growth was very slow. Life on earth was very risky, hazardous, and poor. They did not accumulate property. They had no good way to do that. No way to store. Even if they found a lot of food one day, they couldn't keep it from spoiling for long. So they were always reliant on going to find new sources of subsistence, new food supplies. They could not build anything up. And so they developed institutions, ways of doing things that were consistent with their way of life. Customs. One I've already mentioned, it was sharing, group sharing, communalism. These were not people we would recognize as individualists at all. They probably didn't even think about themselves in such a way. If someone shirked, if someone violated his duty according to the given institutions, he was probably sanctioned, punished quickly. It might simply be disapproval. Others might simply tell him he was doing wrong. Or they might go so far as to banish that person from the group because he had become a burden on the group without contributing to its survival. In those conditions, banishment from the group was almost equivalent to death, because only as part of the group could these people survive at all easily. An isolated individual was almost certain to die. In these circumstances, they developed beliefs, probably what we would call magic, primitive religions. They may have had the idea of a god, gods. Some of them saw gods in everything. Even 1,000 years ago, some of the Germanic tribes of Europe imagined there was a god in the tree, a god in the stone, there was a god in the stream, there was a god everywhere. And it was something to be afraid of, because you couldn't rely on them. You couldn't trust what they might do to you. This was perhaps a way human beings tried to understand the fact that nature was often unkind, that it often caused them harm. There was little or no private property. Everything belonged to the group. Perhaps a few personal items of no great significance might belong to a specific person. Maybe a spear belonged to a particular man after he made the spear. But there was very little private property. The group was self-sufficient. It did not trade with others to improve its condition. And land was abundant. There was always some other new place to go if conditions became too bad where the group was at present. Now, when we get to 10,000 years ago, more or less, we have a momentous change in the course of human history, because we have the development, not everywhere, but beginning in some places, of the agricultural revolution. We have groups that begin to discover or to invent ways of getting food from crops in the same place, staying in that place, and perhaps taking actions to assist the productivity of those crops. We have people domesticating animals so that they now have herds of cattle, goats, sheep, and that means, among other things, they have a mobile food supply. If they have to move, they can take some of their food supply with them, with their herds. That makes life more productive, less risky for them. And even to this day, there are some groups in Africa that count their wealth in cattle. Herders. We still talk about how many cattle a person has as a measure of his worth. It's accumulation. People also began to develop ways of storing their food so that they could keep some of the foodstuffs, grains, they grew, perhaps for months or even for a year or more, and still be able to eat them. So we're beginning to see approximately 10,000 years ago in certain places, such as China, Mesopotamia, we're beginning to see agriculture, established groups staying in the same place, developing their crops, building their herds, accumulating wealth. And when they do that, because they no longer wander around, they build more substantial shelters for themselves. And we begin to see villages for the first time. Before that, people lived in caves. They lived under the trees. They might make tents that were mobile. They could move the tents easily when they moved, so it couldn't be anything heavy. Afterwards, with settlement and with villages, they could build more substantial structures, provide better shelter, also provide better protection for their surpluses when they had them. As their productivity rose, the division of labor increased. Now, with settlement, with some surplus over subsistence, they had a means of supporting those people who did not work to produce food. So they might support someone who spent all his time making tools. Before long, they began to discover, when they encountered other groups, they could enter into exchange relationships with them and began trading. Eventually, they produced larger towns, more trade, finer division of labor. And it is at this point that we begin to see the process by which politics develops for human beings. Politics is the use of forceful relationships to overcome conflicts of interest. See, if we don't all agree about what to do, particularly what to do with existing resources, we can resolve those conflicts only in two ways. We can assign certain rights to resources and then let people exchange rights to better their own interests. We'll have to defend those rights, of course, in case someone chooses to violate them. Or we can resort to force. Resort to force is the political means. Production and exchange are the economic means of resolving conflicts of interest. No other way exists. Some visionaries would have us resolve all our conflicts by love, but that never works very long for a very large group of people. It's too difficult for you to love everyone in Prague. You don't even know them. How can you love all those people? Love requires intimacy, knowledge. It requires what once existed in the clan, when everyone knew one another and cared. because everyone's welfare depended on everyone else's, even their survival. But in the more developed, more productive society with the greater division of labor, conflicts of interest cannot be effectively resolved by appeal to love. It won't work. As groups grew bigger, they began to meet. And when they met, although they sometimes chose to trade with one another, they sometimes chose to fight. Their fighting evolved into a specialized group of fighters, warriors, those men who were most skillful, best, most able and willing to use violence. And from these warriors emerged government, the warrior class. Government, the class that lives off of what is produced by other members of the society and specializes in making war or preparing to make war. Nowadays, no one ever speaks of war. We always speak of defense, even when we blatantly attack someone else. Always defense. Warrior government. Now, these warriors sometimes found that besides defending their own group, they could reach out and plunder other groups. If they were good at fighting, they could go take something away from the group nearby. Of course, the people they plundered were not happy with this situation, especially when the warriors chose to stay there and continue to collect tribute. So they would find ways to resist if they could. If they couldn't fight against those who had conquered them, they would use subterfuge. They would use tricks. They would use sabotage. They would do everything they could to defeat the interests of those who had conquered and plundered them. Now, that makes life difficult for a conqueror. If you want to be what has been called a stationary bandit, as opposed to a bandit who roves around like a highway robber, robbing whoever comes by, if you want to settle down and still be a bandit, that is, if you want to have government, it's almost essential that you establish your legitimacy with the people you are plundering. You have to make them believe that it is somehow okay, it is right for them to pay tribute to. The time-honored way of establishing legitimacy is to make them think that you are a god. And that worked for a number of governments for thousands of years. The pharaohs of Egypt represented themselves as gods. Sometimes the emperors of China represented themselves as either a god or so close to a god it didn't matter. And many other cultures had rulers that represented themselves as gods. Even less than 2,000 years ago, some of the Roman emperors decided they would be gods too. The emperor Diocletian, for example, after first deciding he was not a god, then found it useful to be a god and made the appropriate declaration and demanded that people treat him as a god with all respect due to a god. Even as late as Charlemagne, leaders were still pretending to be appointed by God. This was part of the official title. And only in the past few centuries has divine blessing ceased to play an important role in upholding the authority of governments. But let me just say one or two things more, and I will finish for today. These warrior gods needed propagandists, and that's where the priests came in. Another specialized group of workers, living off the production of the others, whose specialty was the establishment of legitimacy for the rulers. By representing them as gods or gods' appointees, the priests and the rulers, often one, sometimes only closely related, became the ruling coalition of all governments for thousands of years. And in some respects, they remain that way today. I'll start at this place tomorrow when I see you. I spoke pretty loudly.
Yeah.